going to have our oral argument calendar today, January 5th, starting with case number A220815. Counsel, you've all been here before, so you know the rules of appellate procedure. Which podium you choose is entirely up to you. If you'd prefer the middle one, that does rise and fall, but I'll leave that entirely up to you. With that said, Mitch Zillman is our marshal, and I'll ask him to call the first case for consideration.
Now calling case number A220815, Ann Masser versus Madison Blue MOA LLC.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jeff Markowitz, and I represent the appellants, the two Radisson defendants and defendant NSG. This appeal comes down to one underlying legal question. What was the legal effect of the jury's verdict? There was no post-trial motion. No one's arguing any problem with the instructions or the questions. It's just taking the verdict as we find it. What was the legal effect? The jury found that everyone was negligent and at fault, apportioning 40% fault to Ms. Massert, 40% to one of my clients, NSG, and 20% to Radisson defendants, my other clients. The jury did that with the understanding that this would mean Massert could not recover any damages from Radisson defendants, because that's what it was told. It was told this by the district court's instructions that Massert proposed, and Massert specifically told the jury this as to this exact scenario in closing argument. That's why she emphasized so much why it was important, painting a picture when the jury went into that jury deliberation room. Remember that instruction, and that's why you need to apportion more fault to Radisson defendants than her. But the jury disagreed, and what we have to do here, what the district court needed to do, was take the verdict as it found it and decide what the legal effect was, and we respectfully submit that the court erred in doing so. The court determined that Radisson defendants and NSG were jointly and severally liable for their collective fault. That was wrong as a matter of comparative fault law, and indeed the law of this exact case. There's no claim of an economic joint venture, the only basis to aggregate fault under Minnesota law. The common scheme joint liability exception does not apply based on its text and the undisputed evidence. Indeed, Massert argued the opposite. Nor did the jury find that Massert's slip and fall resulted from a scheme of the defendants.
The point in your argument that I wrestle with all the time, because, you know, in the eyes of the law, we always get into all these esoteric arguments about what comparative fault is and what non-delegable duty is and all of that. But, you know, think of this, and this is the way I kept coming back to this case. Common sense: a person is injured, and you have a hotel property, a property that does in fact hire somebody to do some work that is considered to be hotel responsibility. It's not fair to the person that falls if they don't, here's what I'm getting at. A hotel could hire someone at the bottom level in terms of cost, go to the least costly service provider, and then not worry about it because if something happens, well, gee, they're going to be more liable than the hotel is going to be. I can't get around the non-delegable duty, and I feel like that is just the shining star there that we can't separate the two, that it doesn't make common sense.
I think that the point that short-circuits all of the mire that Your Honor is describing is the way this case was tried. And I'll point in particular to what Massert argued in closing argument. Her primary fault apportionment argument was to apportion all fault to the contractor, NSG, none of it to the landowner. And only in the alternative did she argue you could maybe apportion a little to the landowner. We include that in our addendum near the end of the excerpt from the closing argument.
Is that binding, though, in terms of our review?
It speaks to the way the case was submitted to the jury and to what the jury's verdict was. Ultimately, we're asking the jury made findings on this verdict. It answered the questions posed, and it used the instructions it was given. What are binding are the instructions that were given to the jury that Massert proposed and never proposed anything else for. And I note one other point that's important. I mean, this case certainly has a bit of a messy record when it comes to what was the ruling here, what were the rulings that led to this point. But I note an important fork in the road that's important to the resolution here. At the beginning of this, the trial, pre-trial, Massert tried a legal strategy. She asked the district court on the special verdict form to put all three defendants on the same liability line and the same fault line. And she argued that was warranted because there's a non-delegable duty here. My clients and we disagreed. And the district court rejected that and said, no, you're going to have to put on evidence about the fault of both of the parties. Now, what Massert could have done at that point is proposed alternate instructions, additional instructions from anywhere in sections 416 through 425 of the Restatement Second of Torts. But she didn't do that. She proceeded with a duty to warn instruction that came from Olmanson, which came from Conover, in which the Minnesota Supreme Court very clearly held that this duty to warn of a landowner is an ordinary, everyday duty, and that is personal to the landowner. If you look to Restatement Second of Torts, the introductory note to Chapter 15, and we quote this in our reply brief, it refers to those restatement non-delegable duties as the exceptional circumstance. Conover says the duty to warn of the landowner is ordinary. If Massert wanted to put one of the exceptional circumstances before this jury, it was on her as the party with the burden of proof to request those instructions. And I note one more thing. As we're swimming through all of these cases, I think Conover is a bit of a North Star for a lot of the truths that we're arguing here today come down to. Conover says the points I raised. Conover also says that it's for the finder of fact to determine whether, in that case, a 416 or 427 duty was breached. So 416 talks about peculiar risks. Conover says the fact finder, the trier of fact, is the one that needs to find that the risk was peculiar to the work. That never happened here. Massert tried the case she chose to try. The district court got into some complex legal analysis about whether maybe if you squint and look at this case through certain lenses, you can sort of see maybe it's one of these restatement duties, but that's not the analysis. It's far simpler.
So can I ask, it's evident that the two Radisson defendants, although maybe it wasn't explicit anywhere in the record, are considered to be a joint enterprise and to be jointly and liable, right? I mean, there are two entities, but no one's worried about them as having joint and several liability, presumably. They were a single line, the two of them.
At trial, they proceeded as a unit.
They proceeded as a unit. And then, and you're arguing today that although they're represented, you know, by the same counsel right at trial, that NSG and Radisson's were separate units and that it was a plaintiff's duty to put in a factual basis to find both a joint enterprise, and you argue they have to also find a common scheme and plan for the Radissons to be jointly and severally liable, right?
The factual predicates of those, yes.
Yes, the factual predicates of those. But did defense counsel also not effectively say those are legal issues to be determined by the court afterwards? Talk to me about that. Because there are some things that are sort of maybe happening, maybe not super explicitly like, oh, I think the Radisson defendants are a joint, you know what I mean? And so that's what I'm trying to figure out there.
I brought very little extra transcript with me today, but that's the section I brought, because I understand that Massert places a lot of weight on there. I don't think that's true for two reasons. One of them is that this was a discussion. This wasn't a stipulation. This was a messy record where the parties were talking through what was true here. But regardless of that, there was never a question being discussed at any point about whether the district court could make the factual findings necessary to support a non-delegable duty. The only question that was being discussed was whether, if the jury found the defendants negligent on the theory submitted, whether as a matter of law that would make Radisson vicariously liable for NSG's negligence. And as a matter of law, it doesn't. Well, each of the restatement provisions that the district court relied on, 416, 422, 25, have language that's required. For example, 416 requires that the peculiar requires that there have been a peculiar risk that arose from the work. And if you look at Conover, Conover specifically addresses 416, and it says that it's for the trier of fact to determine whether the risk is peculiar to the work. We quote this in our opening brief. And I think that's important. Conover also drops a footnote from that line, noting that whether something is a peculiar risk is a really murky issue. That's something for the jury to determine. And it didn't do that here. And I know one.
The jury also heard. So when she fell, I mean, the night clerk was there, right? It wasn't like, it was in front of the desk, or at least where you're checking out.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it wasn't, it was, the desk clerk or whoever it was could have also said, watch out, those floors are wet. I mean, the jury heard that.
Yes, Your Honor.
So didn't they also have an obligation then as far as a duty? Why would they not?
They had a personal duty.
What I'm getting at is the non-delegable duty that Radisson is now saying that the floor person should have been that responsible party.
And I think what Your Honor is addressing is something that's addressed by the other half of the duty buckets. There's two buckets under the restatement. On the left, we've got all of the personal duties of the landowner. And on the right, we've got the non-delegable ones. Certainly, the jury found that there was a breach of a personal duty of the Radisson defendants to warn and apportion fault. But they never were given any question or instruction that suggests that their answers to those questions implied a next step, that there was some coordination of efforts or jointness here, or that there was the stuff of a non-delegable landowner duty. These are separate buckets. I note at risk of it being lost, I'm addressing this here as one of my primary points because I think Minnesota law is really clear on the framework we're operating under. There are, for comparative fault on the left and joint and several liability on the right, the Minnesota Supreme Court has drawn rigid boxes around those two. If you want to aggregate fault on the left, you need a joint economic venture. That's Camburn.
What is a post 2003 case applying like the current 604.01.02 and 0.01 and 0.02 that tells us that not only does a plaintiff have to establish a joint enterprise under 01, but also has to establish in addition the exception 2 if that's what we're relying on, the common scheme or plan. What's a post 2003 case?
So the only one I can think of is Horst, and it's not entirely on point. It's not precedential. I believe it was Judge Reyes who decided it a few years ago. And the emphasis of the court was that the party was barred from recovery. The plaintiff was barred under 604.01, not under 604.02, that these were separate analyses. And I think that makes sense.
Because under your theory, as I understand it, if you have, let's say, three defendants, 20% each, and a plaintiff with a 40% fault, right? That you have to prove up to aggregate so the plaintiff can recover at all. You would have to prove a joint enterprise under 01, right? And then for joint liability, even if it's a joint, let's assume a plaintiff proves that. It's a joint enterprise. All of the elements are met, so they are a joint enterprise. You're saying that you get to 0.02, it's still several liability for each of those, unless on top of it you prove a common scheme or plan, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah.
And I don't see a case that's post the amendments, and I think it's 2003, right?
2003 amendments, yes.
I don't see a case that really tells us that. That now you have a sort of a double duty of joint enterprise plus common scheme or plan, when in the preceding world, when joint liability was sort of the default, you had one test. This seems to me to ask us to do something, figure out something new, that both tests are required for joint liability.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it would be walking well-traveled land. I do agree with you as a general matter. It seems like any time any court takes a step in this area, there's some Supreme Court review that happens, or there's these murky issues that we run into. But I don't think we get into those murky issues here, in part because of how the case was submitted. And all this case asked the court to decide is, and forget that argument. Forget if 60401 applies, 60402 cannot. Let's analyze them on their face. Let's jump just to 60402.
Yep.
There's a legion of reasons why that cannot apply here. Forget even the submitting to the jury piece. Let's just look at the plain text. It requires that there have been several liable parties that acted in a common scheme or plan, and that action resulted in injury. And here, the jury's theory of liability was inaction, omissions, failure to warn. The plan to have NSG mop the floors was not what injured her. It was the, as found by the jury, the inaction of the parties concurrently that caused her injury in addition to her own negligence. So even if we reach that issue.
Right, it was a failure to warn.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what is it that tells us that a common scheme or plan, you're saying you have to have a common scheme or plan, that means there has to be a decision to take some action that's negligent, and inaction, an omission in negligence can't be a common scheme or plan, even though they commonly scheme to plan. Like, we're going to commonly scheme or plan to do what? Like drag race. I know there was a drag race in case. Something that's like, but you know, the omission was not warning people to stay away. It's like, well, yeah, you had a common scheme or plan, but if the negligence is an omission, then it can't count.
If I see my time is up, if I may briefly respond to this point, Your Honor, I say the plain text of the statute, it requires acting in a common scheme of plan, and that action causes the injury. And if you look at the definition of fault in the preceding section of, so it's in 60401 sub 1A, it actually refers to fault as including actions or omissions. It's a notable narrowing that occurs when we get to 60402, when it just says acting in a common scheme or plan. We go into this more in our reply brief, but that the plain text is all you have to look at, not Wisconsin, but just that. There was, if I may indulge in the court's time, one last piece I wanted to mention. Camburn. Camburn is the other North Star when it comes to whether non-delegable duties can result in aggregation. Camburn, in Section 2 of the opinion, walks through that and concluded no, and that was the Minnesota Supreme Court. I thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Markowitz. You'll, of course, have your rebuttal time, and we'll turn to respondent counsel.
Good morning. Matt Barber here with my colleague, Alicia Sieben, on behalf of the respondent, Ann Massert. Ms. Massert respectfully asks this court to affirm because the district court did not err. The district court correctly interpreted the statute that's at issue 60401 and 60402 and applied it to the findings of the jury and the law of the case. The district court correctly determined that under 60402, in order to have the defendants contribute differently than joint liability, which is what we have here, there needs to be several liability. The district court correctly relied on STOB 1, which is from 2012, and STOB 1 interpreted 60402, and it explained that 60402 does not change the common law about when liability is determined. And the type of liability is critical because 60402, as construed by several Minnesota Supreme Courts, including most recently, I think, the Fish versus Ramler decision, explains that in order to have defendants contribute differently, there needs to be several liability. We need something. In order to get around it, it's anything other than several liability. It could be joint liability, it could be vicarious liability. As the district court points out in its order, there are many ways in which a defendant is responsible for another party's conduct, and that's why the district court did not err. What Radisson is asking this court to do is something that no court has done before. It's asking this court to transpose results and doctrine from workplace and other non-landowner cases to abrogate Radisson's non-delegable duty to maintain its premises, and that's what it has as the landowner. Minnesota common law is clear that landowners have this non-delegable duty to maintain, and in Olmsted versus Le Sueur County, it explains that, yes, the non-delegable duty to maintain includes this duty to warn. So the parsing about changing duty to warn versus duty to maintain, there is no difference there. It's all under the non-delegable duty to maintain.
Go ahead. All right, thank you. I'm trying to wrap my head around this, like, need for several liability and how that intersects with non-delegable duty. I mean, as I understand a non-delegable duty argument, it's that, we'll call it, I don't know why we call it the employer when they have a independent contractor. We'll leave that aside. But we'll call it the employer, the Radissons, the independent contractor, NSG. As I understand, if there's a non-delegable duty given to NSG, but it can't be, that is a vicarious liability situation, and it in fact is several liability. It's Radisson's liability, right? That is vicarious, right? They don't have to have their own separate. I mean, as I understand the way, I think the district court thought of it, and maybe you, but maybe not, is that if Radisson had a non-delegable duty to NSG, it is responsible for NSG's 40% liability.
Correct.
On top of it, the jury verdict says, oh, and also Radisson had a 20% problem for not acting on its own. But it had several liability would be the term that would be, whether it's joint or not, it would be liable if all it was liable for was NSG's. Let's say it was zero Radisson on its own, but fully responsible for NSG, that's still several liability unless a joint liability exception is satisfied, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and I think STOB 1 in 2012 defines several liability and joint liability, and it's easier to address these concepts contrasting them with each other. So several liability is when two persons act independently that causes injury to someone else. They've got their own separate duties. So take, for example, a three-car accident. Defendant number one runs a red light. Defendant number two also fails to use the right-of-way, and they crash into a third person, the plaintiff. Each of those drivers, the defendants, had their own duty to drive with due care that was violated. It's separate and several to them. In our case, the only duty to maintain was owned by Radisson, and NSG only had to maintain the property because it undertook to perform that non-delegable duty. And in the landowner cases, starting with Corrigan in 1900, it doesn't matter if the landowner has any control over what's going on its property. That duty is non-delegable. And it's joint because it's that one duty that's being performed by two persons. It's not separate duties or several duties performed by other individuals. That's joint liability, and that's how we get outside of 60402, because Staub and Fish are clear that the allocation statute only applies when the persons are severally liable. So we get around that. In addition, the statute doesn't change. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying the statutes don't change and don't address non-delegable duty. They don't address a change in the common law about joint and several liability. 60402 only addresses several liability, and it means when you have your own separate duty and your own separate action that causes injury to somebody, then you're responsible for your own percentage of fault. But if someone else is carrying out your own duty, it doesn't insulate you from any fault that might be found for you and for them. And getting back to fairness, as was raised.
Why, under your theory, would NSG be jointly liable for the whole 60%?
It's,
I mean, they didn't have a non-delegable duty. They were 40% liable. I don't understand why, if there's no common scheme or plan under 0.02, why your theory is that it would be jointly and severally liable for 60%.
I missed the first part. Are you talking about NSG, Your Honor?
NSG.
Correct.
Because I think that's what you argue, is that, I mean, I think you argue the district court was right, and the district court found common scheme and plan and, you know, non-delegable duty. But I want to tease it out to understand you're thinking about the operation of the statute. If there was no common scheme or plan found or determined appropriately, let's assume that for purposes of argument, how would NSG be fully responsible, jointly responsible for the full 60%, which is, I think, what you're arguing by saying 0.02 doesn't apply?
We're saying the landowner, Radisson, is responsible
right.
for the whole.
But you're asking us to affirm also the determination, I think, that NSG is jointly responsible for the whole, right? That's the district court's determination.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Would it be without operation of 0.02?
Without operation of 0.02?
Yes.
So the first part of 0.02 is when the persons are severally liable. And our argument is that they were jointly liable because they were each performing the non-delegable duty to maintain that Radisson owned. There were no separate duties or several duties that they were each performing on their own. NSG was solely performing the duty that Radisson hired it to do, and Radisson, as shown by the other landowner cases like Corrigan, can't contract away its responsibility for all of this by hiring an independent contractor.
So under your theory, they're jointly liable from the start, and NSG therefore is responsible also jointly for Radisson's 20%. That's where I have trouble with this theory.
Right.
That's confusing to me.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know that NSG would be jointly responsible. Radisson certainly is because it's the one who owns
that
non-delegable duty. I get
that. I'm focused on NSG to understand why you think that the statute isn't relevant. The statute does seem relevant for NSG. But, okay.
I'm trying to think of a good answer to Your Honor's question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just
yeah.
to clarify, the, and I was going to ask some questions along similar lines to Judge Smith's questions, but if vicarious liability applies, but there's no common scheme or plan, is it your view that the hotel would be 60% liable and there wouldn't be joint and several liability?
I believe that's...
NSG would have... Clarify exactly what liability each party would have if there's only vicarious liability and no common scheme or plan.
When it's under that set of... when it's under that scenario, Your Honor, then I believe that Radisson would be 40% and then NSG would be... Or sorry, Radisson would be 20%, NSG would be 40%.
Even if Radisson is vicariously liable for NSG, I think that was the question.
Oh, sorry, Your Honor.
Is that correct? Yeah, there's no common scheme or plan, but Radisson is vicariously liable.
Sorry, Your Honor. Yeah. There are a lot of different theories floating around here. So, yes, then 60% for Radisson, yes.
And what about NSG?
Because it's
liable?
You're saying two different things. You're saying we have to aggregate under your theory in order to... have there be a compensable claim by the plaintiff, but then when you are looking at the amount of the money, you go back and apportion it between the fault that was decided by the jury, right? So you go back to the 20-40 when you're looking at the numbers. And maybe I'm totally confusing everyone, but that's what I'm hearing Judge Smith say is, okay, so it's not in the fairness scheme of things. It's not fair that Radisson does not have to pony up because they were... a lesser amount, but then on the other hand, why would NSG have to pay the same amount as Radisson because it works in the inverse? So, I mean, don't we apply two different things? We aggregate first to decide if, in fact, plaintiff is entitled to recovery from that person, entity. And then when you are saying, well, here's the dollars that's been awarded because she is entitled to that, then we look at the proportion awarded by the jury.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it's a two-step process.
That's correct.
Right?
Sorry for the confusion, Your Honor.
Well,
yes.
That's what I'm trying to ferret out because I think that's what the issue was. I'm going back to my days from so long ago trying to remember how that works, but I think it's a two-step process. So what case would demonstrate that approach, that processing, if any?
I believe the Fish case, even though it's a workplace, or not a workplace, but it involves an employer-employee and a third-party defendant, shows how that operates. And in that case, the employer was found to be a certain percentage at fault, the third-party defendant was found to be a certain percentage at fault, and then the plaintiff was also found to be, I think, 5% at fault. And the Minnesota Supreme Court looked at 60402 and read that first clause, when two or more persons are severally liable, determined that the employer, because it is immune from tort liability, doesn't have any sort of liability, joint, several, or otherwise, and determined that the plaintiff was allowed to recover for the percentage of fault assigned to the third-party defendant and to its employer, and its the plaintiff's recovery was reduced by his own percentage of fault. So that's, I believe, the framework and how it is addressed.
Well, let's... Oh, go ahead. You do it this time. Go ahead.
Can you address how 604.01 and 604.02 relate to each other? In other words, in addressing
know, whether joint and several liability applies, do you first look to whether someone can recover under 604.01? Basically, you know, the appellants, I think, are arguing you don't ever get to 604.02 because the Radisson's percentage of liability is less than Massard's, so they're not liable, and therefore you can't have joint and several liability. But maybe I'm not accurately characterizing that argument, but I guess I'd like you to address how they look together. Do we look to 604.01 first and then go to 604.02 or not?
I believe it could go either way, Your Honor, and I would like to explain how both of those scenarios would play out. Our first argument is that you look at 604.02 first because it considers when the tort occurs, and it determines what type of liability we have, whether it's joint, several, or joint and several. That's from Stab 1 in 2012. And in that case, we don't need to get into the specifics, but that was a several liability case because there are two separate duties that were breached by the two defendants there. But once we determine what type of liability we have, and here it's joint liability, then we would go to what the jury decided. And that makes sense in the lifespan of a case. We first have the injury, and at the time of the injury, that's when liability is created. And in this case, it was joint liability. Then we get to the comparative fault statute, which is after the suit's been filed, after discovery's done, after the case has been tried to the jury, it's been instructed. And then the jury's job is just to find the facts and apportion fault. Once that happens, then the court would go back and determine, okay, we have joint liability, we are outside of 604.02, and we follow cases like Fish.
So in your theory, 604.02 is not to determine whether there is joint liability. You're saying joint liability is already established outside of 604.02.
Correct, Your Honor.
And the joint liability is established under what is the authority, the test one applies to determine whether there's joint liability in your theory?
In our theory, it's based on the common law meaning of joint liability that's addressed in Stab 1. So Stab 1, it defines several liability, and it defines joint liability, and then it defines joint and several liability.
And what is joint liability? What would be the test that would tell us, yes, there is joint liability here?
Are one or more persons performing the same duty that's owned by one of them, and does that negligent performance result in the injury to someone?
So it's not an aggregation test. It's not a joint enterprise test. And it's not a common scheme or plan. It's another thing.
Correct, Your Honor. And my time's expired, but I'd really like to address that question. The 604.02, it explains when they're severally liable, and then the four subparagraphs are exceptions to several liability. It's different than joint liability. It's different from joint and several liability. It's ways to get around parties who are severally liable from the get-go, if that's helpful. I see my time's expired. Thank you, Your Honors.
I see you're ready to pounce on whatever was said before, but I'm going back.
Certainly.
Just go back just a minute. You know, your argument was their theory of the case, their argument to the jury was find NSG 100% liable. I mean, that was what they said. For that reason, you could put 100% of the fault on NSG, and then they talk about remember to have the plaintiff less liable if that is, in fact, what you're saying. So is there any guidance you can give us that says if the jury, if they're selling that to the jury, that the jury certainly can come back and disregard it, right? I mean, if that's their argument, NSG 100%, Radisson, if they had a little bit of fault, fine. But if the jury turned around and said 100% Radisson, they can do that, right?
The jury could have done that?
Yeah.
The jury gets lots of discretion for apportioning fault.
Right. So then the fact that their theory and their point or their argument, as you were expressing earlier, to pin it all on NSG kind of doesn't really have a lot of leg to it.
I think it does, and I think it's a mixture of a waiver and a fairness argument. Let's imagine for a moment the jury agreed with what Massert explicitly argued to the jury, that there was grounds to place 100% fault in NSG, and the jury did that. That short-circuits this whole analysis, and Massert would have won all of the money she was seeking. But she didn't win on that argument, and then she got a second bite at the apple post-verdict, with a theory that is irreconcilable with trying to place all of the fault on NSG. So it's somewhat of a fairness argument, but also a waiver argument. That's the case she submitted. And the closest case I could find to that is Hansen. Hansen's from 2000 from this court. Former Judge Barry Anderson authored that. We cited in our briefing, it's a joint economic venture case, not a vicarious liability, non-delegable duty case, but it's the closest instructive authority on the waiver piece. Apart from that, there are two things I was hoping to say in my time. One is on the two-step analysis. I brought Horst up with me. It is a 2021 decision from this court, and it's slightly different, but you'll see there's a lot of language there that gets at this this question of how did the 2003 amendments impact prior case law like Camburn. Horst viewed it through the lens of Fish, which is the most recent Supreme Court opinion on the joint and several liability law, and I'm going to read two excerpts. One is, Horst suggests that because Fish does not cite to Camburn, the Minnesota Supreme Court impliedly limited Camburn to its holding and facts, but Fish merely clarifies that the 2003 amendment to Section 60402 does not overturn its prior decisions. Horst's argument that the Minnesota Supreme Court intended to modify a case to which it does not cite when it expressly held that an amendment to a different statute does not overturn its prior decisions is meritless. And there's other arguments to that effect. I point the court's attention to this opinion overall. You'll see there's some differences, but I think it's very instructive. The other piece is pointing to Camburn. Camburn, in Section 2 of the opinion, there's a lot of parallels. It's not a landowner duty case. It's a manufacturer and employer situation where the plaintiff argued for an additional exception, as the Supreme Court referred to it, to the no aggregation rule. The plaintiff argued because the manufacturer had a non-delegable duty to warn and the employer had a separate duty to warn. These were joint duties, and therefore fault should be aggregated. The Minnesota Supreme Court said, no, we're not going beyond what has already been done by this court once. That's for the legislature to do. And in addition, there are policy problems and murkiness, administration problems.
Which case is that again? I'm sorry.
This is Camburn. Sioux Tools, 1982. Quoting with approval a Wisconsin Supreme Court case, the court says, more is required than identical acts or omissions before the negligence of separate individuals may be combined for comparison purposes to determine liability. I point the court's attention to there. I think that's one of its bases. It cites the common scheming exception and
also talks about the common scheme plan.
Yes, Your Honor.
But is that really aggregation if it's vicarious liability?
It is one-way aggregation. So it means that Radisson is holding the liability for both parties, but that the other party still only has liability for its share. This is the case that was submitted. I think there's a lot of murky questions for the court to decide, but we ask that the verdict as it was delivered based on the decisions made by Massard be enforced and honored on remand. Thank you.
Thank you. This is a case where the briefs were very helpful, as well as the argument today. It helps clarify some of the murk that this case does present to us. The matter is submitted, which means the decision will be issued in the statutory time frame.